It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us bow to causes that serve life, truth, justice, the empowerment of the many. All the causes that have been espoused throughout history by our greatest prophets and sages. Their insights linger in our cultural DNA and still tempt us to serve such high, deep, broad pleadings of life more abundant. Let us be appropriately bowed to these transcendent ideals and yoked to their demands on us. For that kind of bowing and yoking cherish us and put within our souls the breath of a God of life and love. But let us never be put into the position of bowing as though we were meant to be on our knees, as though we were inferior beings. And let us not bow too far or for too long to fear. For fear can so easily be used to paralyze our spirits and enslave us. We bend to the voices of a high moral calling. We yoke our spirits to serve life, but not the enemies of life. When we bow, when we consent to be yoked to persons or to causes, let us remember we are children of God, the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself, and the hope of our world. Bowing to callings that are worthy of that spark of God within us empowers us. Let us seek to be empowered and to empower others. Amen.
This is really part four of a five-part sermon series. I've never done more than two sermons on one book in my life, and I'm not even sure I can remember when I did two. So this is unusual. But I think that Naomi Klein's book really is the best thing I've read in 25 years and one of the most important books for understanding what's been going on for the last 35 years in our world. I want to talk about some more applications of this three-part plan to loot national economies that have been done now since 1990, so bringing this more up to date. It was Milton Friedman's economic plan for transferring wealth to the top and disempowering or eliminating the middle class. He wanted to completely undo all the gains of the New Deal. He was very clear about that. Ironically, or perhaps cynically, I'm not sure, one of the names this has been called is free trade. In practice, it looks like this. First, there needs to be what Friedman called a crisis, something to paralyze or distract the citizens to get them off balance for a while. It was very clear that you need a crisis to make the kind of radical changes that he wanted to make. Then the plan is quickly put into effect to sell off government assets to privileged private buyers. The code word for this is privatization. The second part of the plan is to remove all the laws that could get in the way of this easy looting and allow foreign companies, especially U.S. companies, free access
to all their markets without tariffs or taxes that are meant to protect the local economies. That's the free part of the free trade. The code word for this is deregulation. You could also call it just imposed lawlessness. The third part is to disempower and begin to dismantle the people who will always be against this, which means the workers and the majority of the population. You do this by eliminating their social support services and transferring the money from them, again, to privileged private buyers. It's really quite a slick deal. The code words for this are cuts to social spending. If you've been here for even one or two of the three earlier sermons, you know the plot. And you know what's going to happen each and every time. That's part of what's so interesting about this. It may happen a bit differently each time as they react creatively to each kind of crisis. One thing you can count on is that the stories we got from our media were never the whole story. Another is that beneath all the stories of robbery, manipulation, violence, we're really talking about the gods that we are serving as a nation, as we shape or misshape our world. That's my interest in this as a theologian. Now let's start with a country that we all remember being excited about in the 1990s, South Africa, after Nelson Mandela was released from prison, and the African National Congress, the ANC, was given a certain kind of power in 1994. I remember it as an exciting, positive time, but I never heard the deeper economic story. See how much of the rest of this you remember getting from the media. And ask yourself what values, what gods are being served in all of this. To summarize a complex story, the story is that after Nelson Mandela was released from prison, F.W. de Klerk and others made much of the freedom while secretly writing the economic and legal agreement that would ensure that blacks received no economic freedom and in fact had to pay the whites huge sums. So the whites were still supported by the blacks, whose economic condition became much worse. Mandela and the others had been snookered, and so were the rest of us, through misleading or uninformed media coverage. Thabo Mbeki, Mandela's right hand during his presidency and his successor, introduced the Chicago Agenda in June 1996, even saying, "Just call me a Thatcherite," to signal that South Africa was largely for sale to foreigners. How has it worked for the people? You know the plot by now, so the general picture won't surprise you, though the details might. 40% of the government's annual debt payments go to the country's massive pension fund. The vast majority of the beneficiaries are former white apartheid employees. You'll pick up patterns here. So in the end, South Africa has wound up with a twisted case of reparations in reverse, with the white businesses that reaped enormous profits from black labor during the apartheid years paying not a cent in reparations, but the victims of apartheid continuing to send large paychecks to their former victimizers. And how do they raise the money for this generosity? Through taxes and by selling off the government's assets, a modern form of the very looting that the ANC had been so intent on avoiding. Since 1990, the year Nelson Mandela left prison, the average life expectancy for black South Africans has dropped by 13 years. Since 1994, the year the ANC took power, the number of people living on less than $1 a day has doubled from 2 million to 4 million in 2006. Between 1991 and 2002,
The unemployment rate for black South Africans more than doubled from 23% to 48%. Of South Africa's 35 million black citizens, only 5,000 earn more than $60,000 a year. That's 1 in 7,000. The number of whites in that income bracket is 20 times higher, and many earn far more than that amount. We must not pretend that it is a coincidence or an aberration when these economic disempowerments happen in any society, including our own. This awareness of the design behind the destruction, the master narrative, is one of the greatest sources of our hope and of our power. Now let's leave Africa, though its tragic stories may stay with you as they've stayed with me, but there's so much more to tell. For the 1990s saw another dramatic and far-reaching new tactic emerge that you probably didn't know about. On January 13th, 1993, the new Friedmanite rulers were at a small invitation-only conference at the Carnegie Conference Center near the White House, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. John Williamson, the powerful economist known for shaping the missions of both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, that's power. He had convened the event as a historic gathering of the Chicago School tribe. In his address, he raised a stunning, nearly paralyzing question. "One will have to ask," he said, "whether it could conceivably make sense to think of deliberately provoking a crisis so as to remove the political logjam to reform." That sentence has been very powerful since 1993. Let me read that sentence again. "One will have to ask whether it could conceivably make sense to think of deliberately provoking a crisis so as to remove the political logjam to reform." Williamson's remarks represented a major leap forward for the economic shock doctrine. The idea of actively creating a serious crisis so that Friedman's economic shock therapy could be pushed through was now being openly discussed by people who could and did influence economies all over the world. The first country to do this was Canada. Now, what's new in this step is that people within a country are now looting their own country. The financial community in Canada circulated rumors that Canada's currency was in trouble and the stocks were a dangerous investment. Some of you will remember this. These were all lies. They wanted to create a false deficit crisis. By the time Canadians learned that the deficit crisis had been invented and grossly manipulated by the corporate-funded think tanks, it no longer mattered. The budget cuts had already been made and locked into law. As a direct result, social programs for the country's unemployed were radically reduced, successfully robbed, and have never recovered, despite many subsequent surplus budgets. It's a very clever scheme, and it's very effective. The strategy of intentionally creating crises was used again and again in this period. In September 1995, a video was leaked to the Canadian press of Ontario's Minister of Education telling a closed-door meeting of civil servants that before cuts to education and other unpopular reforms could be announced, a climate of panic needed to be created by leaking information that would paint a dire picture. He called it creating a useful crisis. 2 years later, Michael Bruno, chief economist of development economics at the World Bank, These are very influential people, not underlings. Michael Bruno reemphasized John Williams' new plan, again without attracting media scrutiny. In a lecture to the International Economic Association in Tunis in 1995, later even published as a paper by the World Bank, they're not shy, Bruno addressed 500 assembled economists from 68 countries. This is how the plan spreads. He said that there was a growing consensus about the idea that a large enough crisis may shock otherwise reluctant policymakers into instituting productivity-enhancing reforms. Now, this is code language, but soon you'll learn to unpack it yourself. We'll talk about it in a minute. Just in case the audience missed his point, Bruno said, "I have emphasized one major theme. The political economy of deep crises tends to yield radical reforms with positive outcomes." Mm-hmm. Remember to unpack the code words. Productivity enhancing, it's a wonderful sound, does not mean plans to increase production by raising workers' salaries and benefits. It means those legal reforms making it easy for high-level investors to loot the economy of target nations, including their own nation, as Canada had shown. There's no national loyalty in this scheme. It is only about making money. Now, to help create these wonderful profit-taking opportunities, you can feel the excitement building. Bruno argued that international agencies, some of this stuff is actually hard to believe. He argued that international agencies needed to do more than just take advantage of existing economic crises to push through Friedman's fundamentalist capitalism. They needed to preemptively cut off aid to make these crises worse. Bruno conceded that this was frightening. Government salaries would go unpaid. Public infrastructure would rot. But Chicago disciple that he was, he urged his audience to embrace this destruction as the first stage of creation. "Indeed, as the crisis deepens," he said, "the government may gradually wither away." Now this, of course, was seen by a good thing for predatory investors. The effects of a withered government, robbed of its ability to protect its citizens, to provide social support or infrastructure service, these things were never considered. They didn't matter. Once you choose the gods you will serve, you find that all gods are jealous gods. And serving them automatically eliminates some actions even from being seen, let alone considered. These are the plans for economic looting that have run much of the world and been used to devastate and rob country after country under the Nixon, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush administrations in an uninterrupted bipartisan line since Nixon's 1973 CIA-funded coup in Chile. Or even going back to the Johnson administration and our CIA-backed coup installing Suharto as the dictator of Indonesia in 1965. It usually involves finding people within a country who are willing to sell it out, betray it, or even attack it. They may do it for great personal wealth, as the rulers get, or in the service of a far right-wing ideology in which they deeply believe, and which they believe demands violence in order to succeed. And of course, some of them are simply psychopaths, drawn by the violence and the lawlessness. Now, some of the backstory of a lot of the violence and terrorism in the West since 1953 has only barely come to light during the last decade, maybe the last 7 years. There's an important book called NATO's Secret Armies, Operation Gladio and Terrorism in Western Europe,
It was published in September of 2001. Bad timing for publishing a book like that. It's a detailed study of the secret right-wing armies formed by our CIA and the secret services of nearly all Western European countries after World War II, and continuing into recent times, perhaps to the present day. The stated purpose of the violence, which involved the murders of thousands of their own citizens, was both to suppress the left and to induce such fear and terror in the citizens that they would willingly give up more of their freedoms and rights, helping to create a more autocratic state. In the author's detailed research, both former CIA operatives and those active or in charge of many of the secret armies planted throughout Western Europe stated that all terrorism in Western Europe since 1953 was done by the secret intelligence agencies within the victims' own governments. With the tactical and economic aid of our own CIA, they were killing their own people to create the atmosphere of terror that makes people easier to command and control. The author says, quote, "The secret armies were involved in a whole series of terrorist operations and human rights violations that they wrongly blamed on the communists in order to discredit the left at the polls. The operations always aimed at spreading maximum fear among the population and ranged from bomb massacres in trains and market squares in Italy, the use of systematic torture of opponents in Turkey, the support for right-wing coup d'etats in Greece and Turkey, to the smashing of opposition groups in Portugal and Spain." So these bold plans to proactively cripple entire societies and induce an atmosphere of fear or terror, these plans that were spoken out loud by influential Chicago School economists in the 1990s, these were not new plans. They were new variations on old and established techniques that work. Just as their economic shock therapy had footnotes to the electroshock experiments at McGill University in the 1950s. Now we have to move on again. The next happy accident that opened doors for this now perfected scheme of looting a society came through crises that were neither militarily nor economically imposed, but through natural disasters. This is a new market. The first natural disaster the Chicago School group took advantage of was Hurricane Mitch. In 1998, Hurricane Mitch lashed the coasts and mountains of Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, swallowing up villages whole and killing more than 9,000 people. University of Chicago-trained economists immediately flew there to help. Within 2 months, the Honduran Congress passed laws. Now, you'll be able to see this coming. Selling off government-owned airports, seaports and highways, the state telephone company, the national electric company, and parts of the water sector. It overturned progressive land reform laws, making it far easier for foreigners to buy and sell property, and rammed through a radically pro-business mining law, drafted, as you would guess, by the mining industry, that lowered environmental standards and made it easier to evict people from homes that stood in the way of new mines. I don't remember reading about all that. By the time the big tsunami hit on December 26, 2004, Washington was ready to take the Hurricane Mitch model to the next level, aiming not just at rewriting the laws and looting the country's assets, but now also at our direct corporate control over all the reconstruction, thereby squeezing even more money out of these disasters. A year after the tsunami,
The respected non-governmental organization ActionAid, which monitors foreign aid spending, published the results of an extensive survey of 50,000 tsunami survivors in five countries. The same patterns repeated everywhere. Residents were barred from rebuilding, but hotels were showered with incentives to build on their land. Temporary camps were miserable militarized holding pens, and almost no permanent reconstruction had been done. The study concluded that the setbacks could not be chalked up to the usual villains of poor communication, underfunding, or corruption. The problems were structural and deliberate, they said. Governments have largely failed in their responsibility to provide land for permanent housing, the report concluded. They have stood by or been complicit as land has been grabbed and coastal communities pushed aside in favor of commercial interests. It's called privatization and deregulation. Backed up by the guns of local police and private security, it was militarized gentrification, class war on the beaches. This is only partly about a violent economic scheme born in the University of Chicago School of Economics that has wreaked havoc all over the world. More fundamentally, I believe, it is about the gods we serve, the gods our country is serving, and the cost of serving gods that are not worth serving. If you can ignore the plight of the vast majority of people in all these countries, you can see what a terrific opportunity for profit, intentionally created military and economic crises and natural disasters can offer to those prepared to capitalize on them, as Milton Friedman had written back in 1982. But to think that way, you have to serve a god whose heart has been ripped out and replaced by a safety deposit box. Everywhere the Chicago School Crusade has triumphed, it has created a permanent underclass of between 25 and 60% of the population. It is always a form of war, always a form of economic genocide. Let's spend a few minutes on Katrina. Very little will surprise you. You won't be surprised to learn that Milton Friedman wrote in his Wall Street Journal op-ed during Katrina that Katrina was also an opportunity, because now you know exactly what he meant by that. In New Orleans, as in Iraq, which I'll talk about next week, no opportunity for profit was left untapped. For example, there are many examples. Kenyon, a division of the huge funeral conglomerate Service Corporation International and a major Bush campaign donor, was hired to retrieve the dead from homes and streets. The company charged the state, on average, $12,500 per victim. Who pays for all this? In order to offset the tens of billions, I need to back off and see this as a bigger picture than New Orleans. In order to offset the tens of billions of dollars going to private companies in contracts and tax breaks, in November 2005, the Republican-controlled Congress announced that it needed to cut $40 billion from the federal budget. Among the programs that were slashed were student loans, Medicaid, and food stamps. In other words, the poorest citizens in our country subsidized the contractor bonanza in New Orleans twice. First, when Katrina relief morphed into unregulated corporate handouts, and second, when the few programs that directly assist the unemployed and working poor nationwide were gutted to pay those bloated bills. It is clever. Not so long ago, disasters were periods of social leveling, rare moments when communities put divisions aside and pulled together. Increasingly, however,
Disasters are the opposite. They provide windows into a cruel and ruthlessly divided future in which money and race buy survival. While the assets and social programs of a government, including our own, are plundered, laws are rewritten to make the plundering legal, and social supports are cut, helping to weaken and eliminate those who might object. Here's another way to put all this. A small but powerful group of moral midgets has invaded our world. Through tactics of fear and terror, they have put hundreds of millions of people who are their moral and spiritual superiors on their knees or on their backs. It's not right. Can so many good people really be kept on their knees and their backs forever? Would any decent gods or religions honestly sanction such brutality? Could any people of decent and healthy faith abide such an unfair and immoral state? As you've also seen coming, the story is continued until next week.